Hello and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier.
And I'm Peter Johnson.
And we've got a really good show for you today. First, we're going to be talking about some year-end news, what's happening this year, what changes are being made in the tax code, what things you should be looking out for. After that, we're going to talk about international investing.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from one of our listeners, and we appreciate that. And we're going to get into why you should do it, what's involved, how you can do it, some funds we like, and we'll put some show notes up on where you can get more information.
And the show notes will be on our website. That is promoneytalk.com. So please go to the website. You'll find the notes. You'll find a link to our mailing list.
As well as a link to email us if you have questions or comments about the show.
That's right. So first I want to start off telling our listeners we got some good news. Those people on our mailing list have heard already, but those people who aren't, recently Pro Money Talk was ranked number 11 out of over 750 business podcasts at iTunes. So we'd like to say thanks to all our listeners for making the show a success.
And for all of your kind words, encouragement, and questions.
We're hoping to break into the top 10 soon. And
Any day now.
We'll just try to keep giving you good content and let things happen. Now, Peter's going to be starting a new segment coming up. It's called 22 Keys to Financial Peace of Mind. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, the 22 Keys to Financial Peace of Mind is a list of different ideas or topics that I came up with on vacation a couple of years ago that we put into a little pamphlet and mailed to clients. It's designed to help people think about wealth in the overall picture of our lives rather than just focusing on finance. It's designed to address the external, the internal, the attitudinal factors that go into making our overall lives a success. I'm not going to get into the detail right away, but I want to turn that in. I want to gather stories that fall under those different topics and share them with our listeners for the new year.
So from time to time, Peter, in one of our shows, Peter will be introducing one of the 22 keys and explaining it and ideally having a story that illustrates that key.
Exactly. So something for the new year, something I think will be useful. We also have some exciting interviews coming up. I don't know if it will actually appear in next week's show or not. We might have to get permission to play it, but we're going to be interviewing one of the vice presidents at the PIMCO funds about their real return strategy, which is their inflation hedge, if you will, or inflation beating strategy. We're looking forward to that. And then another possible guest up in February that I won't say anything about now, but we're very excited.
That's right. So we have some good stuff coming to you this year. And PIMCO funds, for those of you who don't know, PIMCO's they're the third largest fund family in the world now. They're fantastic, one of our favorites, and we'll talk more about that on that show. Now, end of 2005, hope all our listeners had a nice New Year's, nice and safe New Year's, and we're starting 2006, and there are some changes in the tax codes.
We were looking at things that changed at the end of the year, and obviously tax codes are something that are tied into the calendar years. And we have several things that are working in the favor of savers and investors this year. The first is that there are higher retirement plan limits. The limit for IRAs stays at $4,000 per year, but now the catch-up is $1,000 instead of $500.
So explain that real quick to our listeners. So what you're saying is that people who are 50 or older can put an extra $1,000 into their retirement account?
Exactly.
And those who aren't 50 cannot?
Exactly.
That sounds like discrimination, age discrimination.
Uh-oh. I'm not going to complain. I don't want any trouble. No, but that's the case. That would apply to regular IRAs and Roth IRAs as well. But for 401ks, the limits go up for everybody. The base amount that everybody can contribute is going from $14,000 to $15,000 a year. And the catch-up for people over 50 is going from $4,000 to $5,000. So this year, if you're over 50, you can contribute $20,000 a year to your IRA plan, 401k, excuse me.
That's fantastic. And last year, that was just $18,000. So that's a really nice leap in 1 year.
And this year, we're seeing the introduction of a new 401k plan called the Roth 401k.
Now people have heard of the term Roth before. And to our listeners, you've probably heard the term Roth IRA. This is different. This is a Roth 401k.
And like other 401ks, you can contribute up to $15,000 if you're under 50 and $20,000 if you're over. So you have the higher contribution limits. There are no deductions, no tax breaks or deductions for contributing, but all earnings come out tax-free, which is a tremendous advantage.
A traditional 401k, the money goes in without paying taxes, and then when you pull the money out, you pay taxes. In a Roth, it works the opposite. You pay taxes before you put the money in, the money grows, and when you pull it out, you don't pay taxes. That might be going into detail on that, on Roth, Roth conversions, Roth 401ks. That might be good fodder for a future show. I think this Roth 401k is going to be a big topic in the upcoming year.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what percentage of companies are offering them, but it's probably in the range of 20 to 30%. The nice thing there is that there are no income limitations. So if you're a high income earner, you for the first time can participate in a Roth.
While 401ks don't have income limits, and other types of retirement plans typically don't have income limits, Roths have had income limits. And that's been $150,000 for a couple.
Right, on contributions.
On contributions.
And lower limits for conversions. So here's an opportunity to sock away a lot of money quickly in contributions to a Roth structured account. Also, for those of you who give away money every year, you may be aware that as the giver, you're the one who pays the income or estate tax on the money that you give. However, there is a safe harbor, if you will, of you can give up to $12,000 a year per person. Starting this year, it was $11,000 last year. So a couple could give $24,000 to an individual starting in 2006.
This is exciting for those people who are trying to gift money to their children or even grandchildren slowly over time to avoid potential estate taxation later in life.
Mm-hmm. And concurrently, the one-year gift limit for 529 plans for college savings plans is rising from $55,000 to $60,000.
And that's really great. I want to make a note there that is for the first year only. If you have questions about college planning, go back and listen to one of our earlier shows where we talk about college planning. But 529 plans, every year you can put in up to the gift exclusion, so now $12,000 a year. But the first year they allow you to do a five-year prepay. So the first time you do it now, you'll be able to do $60,000 if you choose. Again, that's a really nice way for people who have several children and have money in taxable accounts to take that money. For instance, if you have four children, you can put $240,000 away into tax advantageous accounts, if you will.
So my question is, if you give $60,000 in the first year, you have to wait 4 years before you give any more?
Yes.
Okay. So that $60,000 really can be made all in 1 year, but it counts for 5 years.
That's correct.
So it's the time value of money that you're getting. You're not actually able to give more.
Right.
Also in the estate tax, the equivalent exemption or the amount in an individual's estate that can be left without estate tax is rising to $2 million this year from $1.5 million last year.
That's
for those
big.
Of you that have been waiting to pass on those larger estates. Now, some of these tax benefits are actually going to disappear in 2010 or 2011. Roth 401ks are set to expire in 2010, and the inheritance tax is set to revert the $640,000, I think it was, before the law started to change. So it'll be interesting to see how Congress plays with these tax laws in the coming years. Even the capital gains tax at 15% is set to expire.
Well, and this speaking on the estate tax, it's important these days, especially with rising cost of homes. If someone passes away and they have a home, it could easily be worth $1 million. And if they're passing that on to their heirs along with some personal savings, a small deduction like $640,000 can go really quickly. And then you're stuck paying the estate tax on the remainder. So this is really nice. $2 million is great.
And some of you are familiar with the bypass trust where you can take a married couple and effectively keep intact each individual's equivalent exemption through proper estate planning, which we won't go into today, but that would allow a couple to leave $4 million without estate tax. Also, Social Security benefits are up 4.1% this year, and the seniors I know are very happy about that. It's a nice raise for them.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of positive news surrounding Social Security for a while, or a lot of positive buzz, so it's nice for them to get a little extra money this year.
And another benefit for high-income earners, this year and next, one-third of the phase-outs of itemized deductions and personal exemptions will be phased out.
Give us an example of a phase-out of an itemized deduction. I'm really confused right now, listeners. Give us an example.
There are certain deductions and exemptions that when you earn too much money, you begin to lose those benefits. And those are called phase-outs.
I have an example that I can give. People who have college loans. Mm. You can write off the interest on your college loan, your outstanding college loans, if you make less than, I believe, $150,000 as a couple. But if you make over $150,000 as a couple, you can't write that off. So that would be something that potentially could be revoked this year.
Well, it's being reversed so that the penalty for making a lot of money is being eased. And okay. I don't know how that's calculated, but just be aware that some of the penalties for earning too much are being taken back, which is an interesting thing. So it's a phase out of the phase outs.
Hmm. I'm thinking about working a little harder now.
You and me both. That's probably why we're here over the holidays. And, of course, there's Medicare Part D, which takes effect as of January 1st. It's really amazing. Medicare covers an awful lot of expenses for people, hospital, medical. But Part D, drug coverage, means the government's going to help out individuals with drug costs. The sign-up period runs from November 15th of 2005 to May 15th of 2006. The reason they're trying to get people signed up quickly, and there is a small 1% a month penalty period starting after that, is because they don't want just the sick people to sign up at first. They want healthy people paying some of the premiums too so they can keep the costs down.
Interesting.
So if you don't sign up by May 15th, you start to pay 1% more every month that you delay after that. There are a lot of ifs, ands, and wherefores with this plan. It's not a simple plan. And if you have certain kinds of coverage now, you can actually mess that coverage up if you apply for Medicare Part D. So in general, though, the idea is that there's coverage that is phased in, and then there's a donut hole, they call it. There's a period when you spend a certain amount of money, it's not covered. So let's go over the different amounts people spend and what the coverage covers.
Well, that's good. I've heard a lot about Medicare D, and I know that there's a lot of confusion. I don't know that we're going to be able to clarify or rectify that, because a lot of the confusion stems from how do you sign up and who's eligible and who's not eligible. But this will give our listeners some good information on what you get when you do sign up, and this will teach me a few things too.
Okay. Well, I was hoping to get a guest on the show covering this topic, and we've had some correspondence with a couple of candidates. Nothing is firm on that yet. But here's what to expect. The individual who has this coverage would pay the first $250 of drug costs out of pocket, so it's a standard deductible. Then from $250 to $2,250, you pay 25% of the cost of the medicine, and the government pays the rest. So 25% of $2,000, that bracket, is $500. That's the most you'd pay out of pocket at that level of costs. From $2,200 to $5,100, you pay for everything. So the cost for that level or that range is $2,850. Beyond $5,100, you pay 5% and the government pays the other 95%. So the most you could pay is $3,600 plus 5% of any costs over $5,100.
Okay. I understand why they call it a donut hole now.
Yep. There's a big gap in right in the middle of it, strangely enough. But of course, the idea is that if people are on the hook for paying some of their own costs, they're going to be a little more careful with how they spend money. And I think that's probably a very good thing. But people need to consider what drugs they take and which drugs are covered. There are lots of different plans out there. And they need to take into account what kind of coverage they already have and whether it meshes well with this. But that's the basics.
Peter, where would somebody, if they don't know, you know, they know what they take, but they don't know how it meshes. And are there any resources, easy resources that people can go just to get more information after they've listened to the show if they want it?
You know, when I was doing research on this a few weeks ago, there really wasn't a comprehensive guide online. But I'm quite sure that Medicare.gov has a guide, in fact, maybe a calculator online that helps you find your way through it. And I'm sure the American Association of Retired Persons, AARP.org, has a lot of coverage on the topic. In fact, they may have people that you can call and talk to. And also, I think you can go to your local pharmacy and talk to the pharmacist. I can imagine they're going to be inundated with questions at this point. But I know a lot of pharmacies are sort of offering that. And then a lot of companies that are offering the coverage, although I don't think their advice will probably be as objective as it could be. So I would probably go to Medicare.gov.
Okay, well, we'll post that on the show notes.
All righty. Sounds good. So those are some of the changes as we go into 2006.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff there. And frankly, the changes sound like they're for the better.
Well, I think all of the tax law changes in the last few years have been oriented towards savers and investors. You know, you're getting a lot of breaks if you're a thrifty, earning kind of a person, which is a good thing.
Yeah, well, that's exciting for our listeners, I think. Well, it's exciting for me anyway. So, great. Now, today's topic is international investing. And we got a question from one of our listeners about international investing. And
yep, Matthew said he enjoys the show and he's catching up on the shows he's missed. He says he is about to graduate and wants to start to diversify into international markets. And he feels fairly knowledgeable about finances, but he had trouble finding information on international investing. I thought it was kind of difficult gathering the information as well. So we'll talk about what an international fund is, what foreign funds are. We can certainly talk a little bit about stocks and exchange-traded funds as well. We'll talk about performance, correlations, or diversification value. Talk about the foreign markets themselves, the sizes and types of them, the statistics. We'll talk about some of the different kinds of funds that invest in foreign markets in different ways. And then we'll finish up with some funds that we like and that we use for our clients.
Why don't you give me the nickel tour really quickly? Can you tell me just right off the bat, why should we invest in foreign investments?
Foreign investments are probably the single best diversifier that you can get that also offer good returns in a portfolio.
Diversification reduces risk, so you're telling me that it's going to reduce risk, and you said that it also can provide pretty good returns.
Exactly. Foreign stock returns have been commensurate or about equal to U.S. stock returns over longer periods, say 25 years. There isn't a lot of good data going back before 1970, unfortunately, but over that the 35-year period, sometimes they outperform, sometimes they underperform, but the average is pretty close. And some people have pointed out that the correlation is increasing, that more often than not, foreign stocks move in concert with U.S. stocks. But the fact of the matter is that any difference between the, or any lack of correlation, anything less than perfect correlation, gives diversification benefits. And as we like to point out to our clients, if you can reduce the risk by just 1% in a portfolio, that accumulates over time, meaning that you'll be shaving off the lower possible returns in a portfolio over time. So the benefits of risk reduction accrue and compound just like a higher return over time.
So international investing isn't something that people do because they're speculators and they're going to do something that's they're looking to do something that's risky and might have a higher return. International investing is actually something that prudent investors do to lower their risk.
Yeah, there's nothing particularly exotic about it. In fact, for our clients, unless they absolutely demand only U.S. stocks, we will, even our older clients, will put one-third to one-half sometimes of their stock allocation into foreign stocks. We'll get into some of the numbers and what that means to you later. I'd like to talk about some of the terminology. We're talking about foreign stocks in general here. Sometimes the mutual funds that invest in foreign stocks are called foreign mutual funds. More often, though, they're called international mutual funds, which means everything but the United States. There's another term, global mutual funds, which refers to foreign funds that also invest in the United States. So international and foreign are the same thing. Global means everything in the whole world.
Makes sense. Okay.
So you asked, why would you want to invest globally? Well, first is investment opportunities. If you think about it, since the U.S. is about half of the world's stock market value, you have more opportunity if you look further afield. Sure. We'll get to the risks in a couple minutes. But you have more opportunities to look over. And some of those opportunities are not as widely researched as U.S. stocks. We can look at the market history and say, gee, they've done well, as we pointed out, as well on average as the U.S. market. From year to year, they take turns in their leadership, so you can't possibly be in the leader every year if you stay in one market. There's growth potential there, as there are in stocks in the U.S. Diversification benefits we mentioned. And what happens when you find somewhat non-correlated assets is that you have the ability then to build portfolios that give you the same amount of return with less risk, or for the same amount of risk to give you higher returns. Most people are interested in performance numbers, and I picked out some from Morningstar today. Now, we're recording the show here on the 3rd of January in 2006, and Morningstar is not going to come out with their final year-end numbers for a couple more days. What they're missing is dividends, and so I suspect that the year-end numbers may be a little bit higher. But some of these are index numbers, too, so I'll give you some idea for 2005. Large cap core funds in the U.S. returned 3.82% in 2005. Mid-cap core funds returned 10.05%. Small-cap core funds returned 6.3%. So it was an okay market for U.S. investors in mutual funds this past year, even though the indices didn't do quite as well. The Dow Jones was actually down a fraction for the year. The NASDAQ was only up 1.37%, and the S&P 500 was up 4.77% for the year. One of the reasons we did well with our clients last year was we used international funds. So the EAFE index, which is the EAFE, that stands for Europe, Australasia, and Far East, which means everything outside the United States, the most commonly used index, was up 13.54% in U.S. dollars last year. The emerging markets were up 30.31% last year. Latin America up 44.92% last year. Europe 9.42, Japan 25.52, Pacific ex-Japan, all the other Pacific Rim countries like Korea and Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore 13.81, and the world outside of the U.S. 14.47. And those numbers are lower than they would be otherwise because the dollar was rising in value last year.
For our listeners, we're starting to put out year-end reports right now, and I've seen a lot of the funds that we use. It seems that the international, we're in the 16% range, 16.5% return on the international funds that we're using.
And there are lots of different kinds of funds that invest internationally, and we'll get to some of the core funds that we use toward the end of the podcast. But anyway, these funds, the indices, would have been a few percent higher, at least in the EAFE index, it would have been about 12% higher had it not been for the dollar appreciating. Because when you buy the foreign funds, you're in those foreign currencies. And if they're dropping in value relative to the dollar, that's happening to you. So that's some of the returns. Actually, over 5 years, too, let me touch on that. The domestic indexes, the Dow Jones for 5 years is down 0.13% per year. NASDAQ's down 2.25%. Standard & Poor's is up 0.5% a year. The EAFE index is up 4.56, and that's really a pretty big gap when you figure that's a five-year compounding of rates. Emerging markets, 16%. Latin America, 18%. Europe, 3.68%. In other words, the foreign markets have outperformed the U.S. markets pretty much over the last 5 years when you look at the big indexes in this country.
As Peter said, that historically that'll change. Sometimes international is outperforming U.S., sometimes U.S. is outperforming international. But the point is that by diversifying, we were able to increase the returns of our total portfolios.
Some investors have told me that they prefer to invest in U.S. companies that have foreign sales, where a good deal of their sales and operations are overseas, like Colgate or Intel, companies that are truly global in their reach, with the idea that they're getting, you know, worldwide performance reflected in their U.S. stocks. But the folks at Ibbotson, which track the numbers long-term, good resource for people looking for data and presentation materials, by the way, Ibbotson.com, they have said that in order to get foreign stock diversification, you really need to buy stocks that are listed on foreign exchanges, that correlations between stocks are higher based on the exchange and the country it's listed in than between stocks listed on different exchanges. So stocks don't just perform according to how the company performs. They also perform in line with the way the whole market performs. And there are many things that are outside of the stock market that have an impact on it, like the price of oil or interest rates, that affect the entire market. And so when the U.S. market gets hit, there's a chance that the foreign markets will not be hit, although they often seem to move in tandem. As I said, any divergence between them at all, even if it's only 20% of the time, still gives some diversification benefit. And when we're talking about long-term investing, we're talking about compounding of these effects. So it becomes very important. So we recommend actually investing in foreign stocks. There are obviously a couple of ways to do that. One is to buy the foreign stocks outright and hold them in that other currency, and some funds will actually hedge the currency risk so that they, through the futures markets, are making it possible for you not to get hurt by a rising dollar or to gain from a falling dollar. I think it adds extra expenses to the fund that may not be worthwhile in the longer run for people who don't mind the risk, because in the long run, it seems that the dollar is losing ground, and in the long run, you're going to make some money by allowing those foreign currencies to float, even though in 2005, that was not the case.
You talked about the different ways that somebody might be able to invest in international stocks. One was, of course, just picking stocks, international stocks, and investing in them. And the world's a big place, and there's a lot out there, and there's different government regulations when you're dealing with foreign countries, and there are some roadblocks to U.S. investors investing in foreign companies. And to that extent, or to the extent that it makes it difficult and, of course, fairly risky anytime you're investing in a single stock, we typically use mutual funds to give us that international exposure.
And it may not be right for everyone. There are certainly ADRs, which are foreign stocks, as they trade on U.S. Stock exchanges, making them accessible U.S. investors, but since we happen to use funds so that we can get expert management and diversification in a broad number of asset classes, that's what we're going to talk about mostly here. So there are a number of different kinds of mutual funds that invest internationally. One of them is an index fund, and just as a U.S. index fund would invest in the stocks that are held in a given index, like the S&P 500, the NASDAQ index, there are mutual funds that invest essentially matching the stocks held in the major indices overseas. A good example of that is Vanguard, which has a developed markets index fund, which invests in two other index funds of theirs, the European and Pacific area funds that are also index funds, as I mentioned. Vanguard also has an emerging market stock index fund. I have one concern about index funds overseas. If you look back over what the average funds have done overseas versus what the indices have done, the average funds have beaten the indices, which is not the case in the United States. I think that's probably because Japan was an underperformer for so long, and funds avoided Japan even though it was a heavy weighting in the index. So that may change over time as well. Or it may be the effect of less scrutiny of international stocks. Fewer experts are looking at them. So there may be more opportunity for sharp managers to add value by finding those undervalued stocks.
So this is a long time sort of argument with mutual funds, and that is active versus passive. Passive meaning you just put it in the indexes and you don't do too much, and therefore the costs are low. Active meaning that there are fund managers who are out there trying to find what they think are the best companies in an area, and therefore trying to add value. Of course, there's added cost to doing that, and so it's a long-term argument. But what Peter's saying is for international, because there are, well, for several reasons, but basically because there's some added inefficiencies in the market, actively managed funds seem to outperform passive or index funds over the long term.
An interesting experiment is to look at Morningstar's Principia, or I imagine you can do it online too, and look at the category of foreign stock funds as a whole and compare it to the EAFE index and just see how it's done over different time periods. That being said, I would still prefer that people own foreign stocks. An index fund is better than not having foreign stocks, and it's not that much different than owning actively managed funds either. Of course, foreign investing entails extra costs of extra research, conversion of the currency, and so on. So normally foreign funds have a little bit higher expense ratio than domestic. We also talk about core funds, and there's no precise definition of that, but these would be funds that we would pick if we only had one choice in a given category.
Sort of the anchor of the portfolio in that category.
Or the meat and potatoes of the food groups, as I like to say. So they're core funds that you can count on, and you'd probably put, you know, Aunt Sally into. There are also funds that will, like U.S. funds, specialize in certain capitalizations, larger cap or small mid cap orientations, or value versus growth types of funds. We're going to assume that our listeners know what those are for today's purposes. As I mentioned, they're hedged versus unhedged as far as currency risk goes. There are also regional funds. So some funds invest just in Southeast Asia or in Latin America or in Europe.
Or in a specific country like China.
There are definitely country-specific funds as well. Some funds limit themselves to developed markets, and some limit themselves to emerging markets, and some can go either place. The core funds that we use tend to have the flexibility to go to the regions that they think are attractive, and of course the countries. They also have the flexibility to go into the emerging markets if they think that there's value there.
I'm going to state an opinion here, and please note that this is not a suggestion to listeners, but this is just an opinion of mine. I think that for a lot of people who are investing and they're getting into international funds, it makes more sense to get into something of a core international fund or even an index international fund to get the broad diversity over all the countries rather than saying, hey, I want to get some international exposure, so I'm going to buy a fund that's country-specific or industry-specific.
I'd agree with that completely. It's kind of like picking sector funds in the United States, and we pick them at the wrong time. They tend to be a little more volatile. People get swept up in the emotion of it. We'll see big outperformance in a given region for a short period of time, and then it's a trap that people can fall into.
And I would submit that the mutual fund managers typically will probably be able to make that decision better than just the average investor would be able to make the decision.
Absolutely. Also, there are exchange-traded funds that invest overseas, and generally those are going to be based on indexes as well. That's what exchange-traded funds generally do. So there are a number of different kinds of funds. Of course, I imagine there are even sector-specific funds, industry-specific funds that cross borders, and there may be more correlation between, say, tech stocks in the U.S. and foreign countries than there is between all U.S. stocks and all foreign stocks. As far as the size of some of the markets overseas, the U.S. at the end of 2004 was about 50% of world stock market capitalization. Japan was about 12%. Other Pacific countries were about 4% of world stock market capitalization. United Kingdom was about 8%. Other European countries amounted to 23%, and 3% was Canada. Just some idea. There was a time when Japan and the United States had similar sized stock markets, which is really amazing.
Amazing. And I'm surprised also that Germany isn't a larger percentage.
Well, it's part of that 23.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I would guess, similar to Great Britain. I think Germany and Great Britain are the drivers in Europe. Global stock market returns in different regions are interesting too. If you look back over this 35-year period, the United States, over one-year periods, calendar year, had a low of losing 26.5% and a high of gaining 37%.
You're saying the worst year it lost 26% and the best year it gained 37%.
Right. Europe, the worst year was losing 22%, a little bit less than we lost here, but their best year was twice as high, 79.8%, almost 80%. And Pacific Rim countries, their worst year was a little worse than ours with 34%, but their best year was 107%. So the upside when it happens is huge. The average return for the different areas is very similar, though, 11.3% in the U.S., 11.1% international in general, 11.8% in Europe, and 10.8% in the Pacific.
That's really interesting. So the average is very close across all those regions.
And the downside seems to be similar over the calendar years anyway.
So that would belie the theory that it might be more dangerous to have, although they could very well be more volatile than U.S. investments.
If you took portfolio over this same 35-year period of 60% U.S. stocks and 40% U.S. bonds...
That's something of a typical portfolio that say, a middle-aged person may have.
Exactly. Your average return would have been 10.5%, and the risk, which is the standard deviation, was 11.2%.
Okay.
A global portfolio, where we increased the bonds a little bit, 46%, had 33% in U.S. stocks and 21% in international. So I think that's 46% of the stock portion of the portfolio, 40% overseas, 60% here.
Okay.
That may seem like a very high percentage to people who are used to thinking in terms of the U.S. But that portfolio over the same period earned the same 10.5%, but the risk was 10% instead of 11.2%. On the standard deviation.
So they had the same average return, but their risk was almost 10% lower.
Yeah. Which is significant. And someday we'll have maybe some graphics to go with our podcast, but I'm looking at a chart of U.S. bonds and U.S. stocks and the efficient portfolio between the two. All of the other country stocks had higher risk and higher returns, but when you blended them into the equation, the entire line, as soon as you start getting out of U.S. bonds, shifted up and to the left, which means higher return and lower risk. So you have this efficient frontier that's moved to the northwest quadrant of the chart.
Yeah, so what we're looking at here is that individual stocks, let's say U.K. stocks, other European stocks, Pacific stocks, had a higher risk than U.S. stocks over the past 35 years.
And higher returns.
And higher returns. When you mix all the different foreign stocks and the U.S. stocks together, you also get a higher return, but with the benefit of reduced risk. So that sort of speaks to our assertion earlier that it may not be in people's best interest, unless they can diversify really well, to pick a certain country or a certain region, but rather to blend them all together.
Yeah, there wasn't a single stock market region that had lower risk than the U.S. here on this chart, but it looks like you could, if I had to average this out, you could either reduce the risk by 1% or you could increase the return by 1% by going to a global portfolio. There are some risks in international investing. One of them is currency risk, which we talked about. Sometimes that works in your favor, sometimes against it. There's also economic and political risk. Obviously, some countries like Russia, they're just shutting down the oil to the Ukraine for a day, and that probably wasn't good news for the Ukraine. Some countries have been known to nationalize their industries. I think Russia's doing that with the oil industry right now, is taking it back into the hands of the government. So the private investors, you know, can lose all their money. So it's another reason to not be in individual stocks and to be not even in an individual country, because things can happen. Coups and governments overthrown, changes in the legal structures and so on. And also we had the Asian meltdown in 1998, which people thought was going to be a huge catastrophe worldwide. It turned out to be a big deal in Asia. I mean, their boom just stopped in its tracks for a couple of years. Didn't hurt us as much here, but it was dramatic. It was really dramatic for our region. There's also market liquidity risk. The other markets are not quite as liquid. They don't have as much money coming and going every day as the U.S. market. That would also argue for being in larger cap stocks. There are differences in accounting standards. the Asian crisis was precipitated by a lack of transparency. That means investors were all excited about the growth prospects, and then all of a sudden one day they woke up and said, oh my gosh, I don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. I know I'm making good money, but all of a sudden fear took over. We want to know with certainty what these companies are earning and how their balance sheets are being made up. And we don't like to invest when there's a lot of unknowns. Risk is anathema to investors. And some of the accounting standards maybe play a little fast and loose overseas. And then there are the extra costs of investing internationally. So there are definitely some risks of investing internationally. Although I think the world as a whole is opening up to freer trade, to more standardized accounting, to better understanding, to more transparency. We certainly have seen evidence of that. PIMCO's backed that up with what we've read recently about their developing markets fund. So the benefits to global investors as confidence builds and as risk is reduced can be like a little tailwind to the investments that we have overseas. Even if the outlook didn't change for the companies and the countries, if people had less fear and more confidence, then certainly that's going to be good for those stocks.
All right. Well, that's a lot of good information, Peter. I guess to summarize, international investing can reduce risk and potentially increase returns. It's good for diversification. It can be difficult to pick individual international stocks, just as it is to pick U.S. stocks, but even more so because there's so many out there. The world's a big place.
You've got the accounting standards that you have to deal with, and maybe not as much in the reports, but you have to understand each country's reporting standards. So to wrap it up, I'd like to mention a few of the mutual funds that we use in our practice. As I mentioned, for index funds, if we were going to do that, we would probably use the Vanguard funds. There's the Developed Market Index Fund, which includes Europe and the Pacific countries. They also have the European Index Fund, the Pacific Index Fund, and they have the Emerging Market Stock Index Fund. In the way of core funds that we use Harbor International Fund. They have a number of different Harbor funds. We're talking about the one with the symbol H-A-I-N-X. They also have a Harbor Growth Fund, and they have a retail shares. I think that's H-I-I-N-X. But Harbor International is a fund that balances growth and value pretty well. It can invest in emerging markets when they think it's appropriate. The manager's been there for a long time. Certainly been a good performer for us. On the growth side of things, but still large cap, Artisan International Fund, ARTIX, is a fund that we like a lot. On the value side, the more conservative side, Dodge & Cox International Fund is a standout. In fact, the manager was chosen as Manager of the Year by Morningstar in 2004. The symbol for Dodge & Cox International is DODFX. And for a more conservative type of fund, Mutual Discovery has filled the bill with good returns, MDISX. Sometimes smaller investors may not have the minimums required for some of these funds. There may be sister funds in the fund family that have lower minimums with slightly higher expenses.
I also like a fund called Polaris Global Value. It's a value fund, and it's mid-large cap. That's not so much a core fund, but something that would be something of a supporting fund, maybe. Now, all these funds that we mentioned, the thing with mutual funds, of course, is that they can close and open at any time. In fact, there are a lot of good international funds that we've used over the years that are closed to investors now, like Vanguard International Explorer and some others. So these are sort of what we're using today. That might not be what we use tomorrow or.
I guess we should say that, you know, you need to do your own research, that we're not recommending these funds to anybody in particular. We don't know your situation, but these are the funds that we use as core funds with our clients. So they're a good place to start your search.
So mutual funds are a good way to invest in international, and certainly for those people looking for diversification, investing in international mutual funds that cover a variety of regions and industries probably makes good sense. So I hope that was helpful. And if anyone has any questions or comments on that, please feel free to contact us. You can go to our website, promoneytalk.com, and leave us feedback on the show or email us with questions. While you're at our website, if you'd like to sign up for our mailing list, please do so, and we will promise not to spam you, but we send out before every show an alert to our listeners that say, you know, the new show is up, and this is what the new show is about, and we give a little bit more information.
If we have contests or promotions or special offers, we'll put them in there too.
So hope you enjoyed the show today. We enjoyed talking to you. Next show is going to have a guest, hopefully, and think you'll find it interesting.
And I'm always looking for those success stories, so please don't be shy. Contact me through the website if you have an idea or if you just want to ask me questions about it. I am looking for stories that'll fit the 22 keys to financial peace of mind. And I have some stories that fit into some of the categories, but need more stories. And really, it could be inspiring to other people. We can keep the name private. That's not a problem. But we're looking for people who have mastered some aspect of their financial life and have found some sort of security or lack of worry or some joy in that.
Good. Well, we love your feedback, all your feedback, and we'll see you next week. So until then, I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
And here's to your success.